The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline, Rewind, the Year in Review. And the first page in this bunch of articles is Rewind 2020 by Lauren Onasorge. Bandwidth rolls on. Bandwidth sees growth in 2020, plans Raleigh expansion. A pandemic couldn't slow Raleigh-based Bandwidth, which, despite the growing viral threat, announced plans to create more than 1,000 jobs in Raleigh at a new $100 million headquarters. The communications technology firm picked its hometown over competing locations in New York and Colorado, both of which offered incentives packages. Public records show New York was considering a package worth between $12 and $15 million, and Colorado could have funded between $10 million and $11 million. Instead, Bandwidth picked North Carolina, which offered up an incentives deal worth more than $33.9 million. And it's not just building office space and offering high salaries, estimated to average $101,660. CEO David Morkin plans to build a Montessori school at the site to support employees' children. Bandwidth, which counts as customers Google, Zoom, and Microsoft, embeds voice messaging and 911 access into software and applications. And it has been growing, both in dollars and international footprint. Bandwidth announced the $527 million acquisition of Voxbone, expected to expand its platform into more than 60 countries worldwide. Morkin said the deal accelerates Bandwidth's international expansion by several years. Voxbone, a communications platform and IP voice network, counts Uber, Zoom, and Skype among its customers. With Voxbone, Bandwidth will be able to reach about 93% of the global economy, Morkin has said. Additionally, Bandwidth reported a revenue boost in October, which was already aided by both the election and the pandemic. The election meant elevated usage in messaging, Morkin said on a recent earnings call, and the firm continues to benefit from the work-from-anywhere dynamic caused by the ongoing pandemic, he said. The communication software firm, which serves more than 2,000 communications platform-as-a-service customers, a 25% increase over last year, reported 115 net new customers in just its last quarter. The firm reported third-quarter revenue numbers in October of $84.8 million, up 40% over the year prior, and the election and the pandemic added up to about 12% of that growth, with 7% coming from political messaging volumes and 5% from COVID-related usage. Travel starts to inch up slightly as pandemic hammers RDU. With a 70% traffic drop, travel at Raleigh-Durham International Airport tanked in 2020. And while numbers have inched upward, they are nowhere near 2019 levels, causing airport officials and airlines to make difficult choices. Even the Thanksgiving travel week at RDU was disappointing at 103,000 passengers, a 64% decline over 2019. With herd immunity due to vaccinations likely not occurring until at least mid-2021, it won't be until 2022 or maybe even 2023 that air travel reaches pre-pandemic levels, said Mike Walden, an economist at NC State University. RDU has taken major measures to compensate. The airport established a voluntary separation incentives program based on age and years of service. As of December 18, employees had opted in, saving $2.3 million in payroll, including the 22 others who left in 2020. That's a savings of $4 million. And more than 150 employees volunteered a combined 1,800 hours working on tasks such as painting, landscaping, and janitorial duties, saving more than $157,000. One of the biggest cost-cutting measures involved shuttering parking facilities. By December, just the garage between the terminals, the Central and Premier decks, was in operation. For the first 6 months of 2020, RDU gleaned just $4.6 million from parking, compared to $35.2 million the year prior. With the pandemic, the airport had budgeted for $16 million, a total it was unlikely to meet. Parking is typically the airport's biggest revenue generator, so on a survival budget, the airport cut its total spending by nearly half deferring $96 million in construction projects. Officials are hoping many suspended flights will return. The airport implemented an incentives program for airlines. Nonstops to London and Paris are scheduled to return in early 2021. A year ago, there were 57 nonstop destinations. As of December, there were 37. And our last article in this section, banks work with firms as PPP flows. The Paycheck Protection Program meant late nights for bankers across the state, scrambling to get the paperwork in on time amid changing guidance from the U.S. Small Business Administration. SBA numbers show 39,520 North Carolina businesses were approved for about $8 billion from the PPP, an average of about $202,400 per business. For some banks, the PPP paid off. Take Fuquay Varina-based Fidelity Bank, a $2.7 billion bank that made a whopping 3,750 PPP loans, totaling a combined $318 million, salvaging 42,000 jobs, according to its data. CEO Mary Willis said many of those loans went to new customers, clients she expects to keep. While many PPP loans have been forgiven, top-tier loans are giving executives headaches after the SBA rolled out a questionnaire that critics say asked for information borrowers couldn't possibly have known. Meanwhile, at least 300 U.S. banks have been pushed across costly regulatory thresholds due to the $525 billion in PPP loans processed by banks. Two local examples are North State Bank and Dogwood State Bank, which moved past the $1 billion and $500 million marks, respectively, thanks to PPP loans and stimulus deposits. But both North State and Dogwood already had aggressive growth trajectories. "It just happened faster than we thought," North State CEO Larry Barber said. And now we turn to Rewind 2020, Caleb Harshberger. Reaching for the sky, multiple projects in Raleigh are looking at rising 40 stories. Downtown Raleigh continued its flirtation with the 40-story barrier in 2020 as the city continues rezoning parcels allowing for development up to that height. The city kicked off the year with several parcels newly zoned to allow for development up to 40 stories tall and would later approve several for that height. Meanwhile, developers continue to provide a steady stream of new requests for potentially towering new structures. Among 40-story zonings in 2020, the Raleigh City Council approved the first in February, a collection of properties at the corner of West Martin Street and west of South Harrington Street, which includes such area icons as Cam Raleigh and Raleigh Founded. Later, the council approved Wilmington-based Zimmer Development's request to develop a mixed-use tower up to 40 stories tall at 506 and 508 Capitol Boulevard near Kane Realty's Smoky Hollow project and Hoffman Associates' Seaboard Station. So far, site plans have yet to be filed for these projects, and it's unknown exactly how high they will go. Muddying the waters is the city's limited zoning offerings at this height. For developers considering a high-rise development, zoning designations are limited to either up to 20 stories or up to 40 stories, meaning any project in between would need a 40-story rezoning. Meanwhile, it's possible that the fallout from the pandemic could add uncertainty to the market and impact the financing for ambitious projects. Still, that hasn't stopped developers from filing new rezoning requests this year, including Highwoods Properties with an assemblage of properties across from the Dillon and Turnbridge Equities with the Creamery property in Glenwood South. Kane Realty also filed for a 40-story rezoning for its Downtown South project, though later conditions reduced the maximum height that would be allowed at the project. Meanwhile, some owners and developers with recently rezoned properties continue working on plans for the sites. Notably, work continues on Kane's Smoky Hollow site, though no plans have yet been filed for Phase 3, which the council rezoned last year. Elsewhere in the city, Greg Haddam's Empire Properties has continued its consolidation of the 200 block of Fayetteville Street after the council rezoned much of the block for up to 40 stories. Visitors' jobs disappear in retail and hospitality sector. Hotels and retailers kicked off 2020 with big expectations, and then the pandemic hit. Almost overnight, business plummeted. In Durham, hotel occupancy dropped from 80% to 22% in March as corporate travel dried up and events were canceled. By October, in Wake County alone, 308 conventions, meetings, and group sporting events were canceled, with 49 conventions, meetings, and group sporting events rescheduled for a future date. Layoffs spread as hotels couldn't afford to keep staff. Iconic Triangle Hotels furloughed and laid off staff as the impact deepened throughout the year. The J.B. Duke Hotel and the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club at Duke University turned furloughs into permanent layoffs, according to NC Department of Commerce notices. Before that, Carla Munoz, human resources manager, told Commerce that Sheraton owner PM Hotel Group placed 140 employees at the South Salisbury Street Hotel on temporary layoff March 27. Eventually, dollars began trickling back in, and by October, area hotels had clawed back some business, with occupancy ticking up to between 35.5% and 49% in Wake County as of November. Still, revenue is down as events, corporate travel, and tourism remain suppressed. In Wake County, hotel tax collections plummeted by 52% from January to October compared to the same time frame last year, according to the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's a drop from just under $26 million in 2019 to $12.2 million. Durham is seeing a similar trend, with projected hotel revenue down $100 million from last year, coming in at $126 million in 2020, according to Discover Durham's annual report released recently. On the retail and restaurant side, local businesses have struggled, with food and beverage tax collections down 24% from January to October compared to the same time frame last year. And finally, Hot Market is pushing Triangle's limits. The Triangle residential market reached new heights in 2020 amid cratering interest rates and population growth, boosting values across the region and straining the housing supply. The year began with a strong first quarter, then COVID-19 hit and the industry braced for a slowdown. However, the Fed slashed interest rates, and within 2 months, the market was back on its feet. By September, the market was shattering records in showings, home listings, pending listings, closed listings, overall sales price, average resale sale price, and scarcity of housing supply. This would continue in the months to follow, even as all this activity saw what few homes were left subject to bidding wars and accelerating price growth. Median sales price for property in Wake County peaked at $329,000 in October. This included commercial sales, although residential sales make up the bulk of the sales. This continued in November with a shocking 10% increase in home sales prices and a 17% increase for resales year over year, according to industry analyst Stacy Anfinson. Meanwhile, showing somehow continued to be well over last year's numbers, and even as supply came in at around 50% of what it was in November 2019. Now, Anfinson says buyers in Raleigh struggle to find homes below $400,000 and increasingly look to towns such as Zebulon and Roseville, which are seeing rising home builder interest. Bankers were flooded with mortgage requests between buyers for new homes and homeowners looking to refinance. I've been here in Raleigh with Perennial Mortgage Group since 96, and this is the busiest I've ever been, branch manager Casey Connell said. It's nonstop from the minute I walk through the door until I go to bed, and I'm still not caught up. And now we turn to Seth Thomas Gulledge's Rewind 2020 page. The first headline, Providers Go Digital. Telemedicine surges as healthcare providers pivot in pandemic. It's hard to imagine a year more impactful than 2020 for the healthcare industry. Faced with a global pandemic, providers all across the triangle threw their focus into fighting COVID-19, even if that meant making some serious sacrifices. And those sacrifices came aplenty for the many providers, prompting policy changes and larger conversations about how COVID-19 exposed flaws across the industry that could mean changes long after the pandemic dissipates. The hardest hit in the triangle were smaller independent providers. Those providers, just like their larger hospital counterparts, were forced to cancel or delay elective procedures in an effort to free up personnel and limit spread of the virus. Cutting those procedures came at a huge cost, with the North Carolina Healthcare Association estimating that it cost its hospital members as much as $1 billion a month at the height of the lockdowns. But unlike hospitals, which were faced with unprecedented volume, delaying elective care and closing offices for smaller providers meant a complete cutoff of revenue for specialty practices and independent family providers, leading many to pressure government payers and private insurers to rethink policies that could help them keep their doors open. Most substantially, that change came as a quick transition to telemedicine, with patients and providers both feeling more comfortable delivering care remotely rather than in person throughout the pandemic. With that came a policy adoption by both Medicare and Medicaid payers and private insurers such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, which enacted payment parity for telemedicine, reimbursing providers the same as in-person visits. And while insurers such as Blue Cross have promised to keep the policy in place for the duration of the pandemic, providers are gearing up for a larger fight about what policies need to stay in place to encourage this modality of care, which they say, pandemic or not, increases access to care, especially for rural areas. But insurers may not be keen to keep those policies in place. In addition to COVID-19 also meaning less claims related to its line of business, Blue Cross has also felt compelled to roll out more than $800 million in commitments through different policies and canceling copays for COVID-19-related treatment. And COVID-19 is still far from gone, even though vaccines have started to arrive. Virtual trials, new reality as pandemic changes landscape. With a COVID-19 vaccine rolling out, many life sciences firms are ending 2020 in the spotlight, but the year has been far from easy for many, if not most, Triangle firms. As the global hub of contract research organizations, the Triangle is home to the industry's largest companies such as ICVIA, PRA Health Sciences, and Duke Clinical Research Organization. The industry provides thousands of high-paying jobs to the Triangle by helping pharmaceutical companies and researchers turn drug ideas into commercialized products by conducting clinical trials on behalf of those sponsors. But to do so, those CROs require countless investigational sites across the globe, relying on millions of potential patients to enroll in their clinical trials. But also overnight, COVID-19 shut down as much as 85% of those sites. Faced with the prospect of nearly all of their trials suspending or ending, coupled with intense pressure to find ways to test COVID-19 treatments and vaccines, the CRO industry turned to a modality that many industry insiders have said was little more than a novel idea worth exploring in the future, remote trial monitoring. In the course of a few short weeks, the major players of the CRO industry rolled out exhaustive options for remote clinical trials, finding ways to keep drug trials moving and even launching new ones with limited or even non-existent physical access to patients. It absolutely has acted as a floodgate in terms of accessibility of virtual trial approaches, says Jessica Perry, ICVIA's Director of Operations for Clinical Trials. One of the things that we've really seen is that there really is a need to be able to provide solutions that allow for patients to be able to participate from their home. And no one expects that floodgate to close now as firms are realizing the benefits of virtual trials, including quicker enrollment and closer patient adherence. For life sciences research outfits, aside from a number of new spin-outs, the banner achievement has been the Triangle's AskBio, landing a $4 billion deal with Bayer. And finally, empty campuses hit college coffers. 2020 was not a banner year for higher education institutions across the country, and the same is especially true in the Triangle. With the stadiums left empty, campuses deserted, and dormitories empty of students, every college and university in the region faced a financial crunch. Aside from a slight reduction in tuition dollars from students who decided to postpone or forego the college experience in light of it all, the amount of impact that universities came from enterprises not related to teaching. These so-called auxiliary enterprises or higher education of higher education are related to every part of the student experience other than actual education. From athletics revenue to on-campus housing and dining and even souvenir and bookshops, the auxiliary revenue is often behind what makes many institutions larger and broader reaching than their peers. According to an American City Business Journal's analysis of student-related revenue at U.S. universities, a 50% reduction in auxiliary enterprises revenue could cost Triangle universities more than $340 million collectively. That loss has led many universities, including Duke and East Carolina, to announce rounds of layoffs, with ECU even announcing it would furlough its chancellor to save money. And it might still be far from over. During an October meeting of the University of North Carolina System Board of Governors, James Holmes, chair of the Budget and Finance Committee, forecasted new funding needs. Many have pointed out that the universities best suited to thrive in the pandemic are the mega universities across the state with massive endowments and diversified revenue streams that make them more resilient to any single issue, leaving many other institutions behind. And now we turn to Rewind 2020, written by David Pertell. The first headline, "The thrill is gone. Restaurants cave in to mass closures in unprecedented crisis." The economic calamity resulting from the pandemic rippled through nearly every industry in 2020, but none was hit harder than the restaurant and hospitality sector. For the Triangle and across North Carolina, the impact was immediate, March 17, when Governor Roy Cooper ordered restaurants and bars to halt dine-in service indefinitely as the number of COVID-19 cases accelerated. Within days, thousands of jobs had disappeared and some businesses were shutting down completely. A trend continued until May 22nd, when restaurants were allowed to resume dine-in service at 50% capacity, a rule that remained in place for the rest of the year. Bars weren't allowed to reopen until early October, but only for outdoor service with extremely limited capacity. The result is that dozens of Triangle establishments are no longer in business, from relatively new ones such as High Horse in Raleigh, which opened in 2019 but closed for good in July, to longtime favorites such as Ye Olde Waffle Shop on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. The breakfast spot had served University of North Carolina students for almost 50 years. It closed in March, and in early December, the owner said the business would close permanently. Other prominent Triangle restaurants to close in 2020 included Gonza Tacos and Tequila, and Deluxe Chicken in Durham, Gaurav G. Patel's Cameron Bar and Grill in Cameron Village, Ashley Christensen's Chuck's Burgers, and the Gateway Restaurant in Raleigh, Elmo's Diner in Carrboro, and Lula's in Chapel Hill, just to name a few. Across the country, nearly 100,000 restaurants, close to one in six, had closed for good by September, leaving 3 million workers jobless, according to the National Restaurant Industry. The industry was on track to lose $240 billion in sales by the end of the year. "It's been a very difficult year," said Lou Machakos, owner of Raleigh-based LM Restaurants. But the crisis also highlighted the resilience and creativity of business owners who found ways to stay open and keep employees working. Many found new revenue streams through carryout and deliveries. In the early weeks of the pandemic, Jeff Janik, owner of Milton's Pizza and Pasta in Raleigh, didn't lay off any of his 157 employees. Instead, he slashed menu prices by 50%, thinking eating out would become a necessity as restaurants turned into a food delivery source like a grocery store. Other owners, such as Christensen and Gus Gussler of the Players Retreat, decided to keep their establishments closed to dine-in service for the sake of their employees' health and safety. Their decisions were buoyed in part by the $659 billion Paycheck Protection Program offered through the CARES Act passed by Congress in March. Throughout North Carolina, more than $518 million worth of PPP loans, 5,000 loans in all, was allocated to full-service restaurants, keeping workers on the payroll in the early months of the pandemic. On top of the pandemic, the Triangle restaurant scene was rocked in June when Vansana Nolintha, co-owner of Bida Manda and Brewery Bhavana, left the company amid allegations of sexual harassment in the workplace. Eventually, the restaurant's other co-owners, Patrick Woodson and Vanvisa Nolintha, stepped aside. And Frederick Leonard, formerly with Giorgio's Hospitality Group, took over as CEO. As summer turned into fall and it became clear more federal aid wouldn't arrive anytime soon, restaurant owners and industry advocates spent the second half of 2020 pleading for more relief from Congress. New concepts rise gingerly. Despite the incredible hardships for restaurants in 2020, there were plenty of new eateries that opened in the Triangle, while some familiar names launched new concepts. Early in the year, Chef Matt Kelly's St. James Seafood in Durham reopened after being closed for months following a deadly gas explosion in Brightleaf Square. Amid the pandemic, the store rebranded to Jimmy's Dockside in the summer. In December, it temporarily closed again. In Knightdale, pitmaster Chris Preto opened Prime Barbecue in May and was able to keep business steady. Perry Steakhouse and Grill opened in August in the new Crabtree Terrace building across from Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh. Also in Raleigh, Lone Rider Brewing launched its third hideout location and first full-service restaurant in the space formerly occupied by The Point at Glenwood Restaurant in Five Points. Restaurateur Gaurav G. Patel opened a cocktail lounge, Killjoy, in July in downtown Raleigh. Raleigh restaurateur John Sealbinder reopened a revamped Virgil's on South Salisbury Street downtown after he decided to transform the space into a dinner and late-night spot. Next, we have a Rewind 2020 page written by Dane Huffman. North Carolina sees divided government. Cooper wins, but Republicans hold on to House, Senate. North Carolina's split personality was evident again at the ballot box in 2020, as the Tar Heel State again voted for a divided government and set up what could be a contentious 2021 as dollars become more scarce. At the federal level, North Carolina voted for the Republicans at the top of the ticket, with President Donald Trump and Senator Tom Tillis winning. For the House of Representatives, the state elected 8 Republicans and 5 Democrats, and none of the races were close. But at the statewide level, it was a different story. Democrats won significant individual victories, but the state wound up with a divided government. For the Democrats, Governor Roy Cooper, Attorney General Josh Stein, State Auditor Beth Wood, and Secretary of State Elaine Marshall all won re-election. For the Republicans, Treasurer Dale Folwell, Agriculture Secretary Steve Troxler, and Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey won re-election. And winning office for the GOP were Mike Robinson, Lieutenant Governor, Josh Dobson, Labor Commissioner, and Catherine Truitt, Superintendent of Public Instruction. Perhaps more significantly, the Republicans maintained majorities in both the state Senate and House, but not enough to override a Cooper veto. And that has important implications for the state ahead, especially as it looks to recover from the pandemic. Cooper and the GOP legislative leaders have clashed over budget issues for years, with Cooper seeking expansion for Medicaid, higher raises for teachers, and raising concerns about the corporate tax cuts enacted by Republicans. Cooper has also pushed to raise the $350 per week cap on unemployment support enacted by Republicans. However, the state is heading into an uncertain 2021. In May, the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division revised projections to show the state could expect to come up $2.57 billion short of the projected $26 billion in revenue for 2020 to 2021. That revenue drop comes at a time when many key services of the state, including its university system, have been crushed by the pandemic. And that means the demand for the state's revenue will be high and will set up contentious decisions in the year ahead. PNC Arena, others face diminished tax dollars. A promising consensus in August 2019 between the Wake County Board of Commissioners and the Raleigh City Council set the stage for dramatic investment in 2020 from the monies raised from the county's interlocal agreement. The dollars raised from hotel and food taxes were expected to hit $63 million for the fiscal year that ended June 30. With $30.5 million from occupancy taxes and $32.5 million from food and beverage taxes, that was a big surge from the $60.5 million raised the year before. And so, in back-to-back meetings, the Wake and Raleigh governing bodies approved a hefty $9 million per year over 25 years to the PNC Arena to fund major upgrades that would satisfy Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon. The Centennial Authority, the governing body for the arena, announced it had approved a 5-year lease extension with the Carolina Hurricanes. The deal keeps the Hurricanes in Raleigh through at least July 1, 2029. As for the interlocal agreement, the remaining dollars would be distributed among other projects, all with the goal of growing tourism as the competitive process continued. And then in March, the bottom fell out. Hotels and restaurants were among the first and hardest hit casualties when the pandemic hammered the American economy in March. Suddenly, confident revenue projections from 2019 seemed meaningless as Wake County hotels saw capacity drop to a staggering 24%. By April, Denise Foreman, the assistant county manager overseeing the process, was projecting interlocal agreement revenue would come in 20% lower than budgeted and perhaps even worse. So Foreman and other leaders suggested the commitments that had been made, such as to the PNC Arena, remain, but that the county and city delay the other decisions. Right now, what we will be recommending is pausing on any decisions, Foreman said at the time. We want to get a better sense of our projections today, how our projections today will line up with actual projections. Still, the Centennial Authority, which runs the PNC Arena, has its challenges. Executive Director Jeff Merritt said the authority is looking at a loss of roughly $1 million in an annual budget that spends around $5 million on maintaining the building because of the coronavirus. The impact of the pandemic sent some projects scrambling as interlocal agreement dollars slipped away. The Downtown South project, driven by North Carolina Football Club owner Steve Malik and Kane Realty CEO John Kane, got approval from the Raleigh City Council on a rezoning request and is looking for different ways to get public support to finance the project. In Briar Creek, Rob Autry and Jason DeGroff had hoped to break ground this year and open next year on a racket project that would cost $65 million to $70 million. The project had hoped for $20.6 million in interlocal funding. So Autry and DeGroff pivoted to a project with less indoor space, but still with 34 tennis courts, 29 pickleball courts, and 12 courts for the fast-growing sport of padel, a cross between tennis and racquetball. And our final Rewind 2020 article is written by Cameron Snipes. Racial unrest yields deeper conversations. Violence erupts as businesses were forced to board up storefronts. It took just a handful of days for the protests that were sparked by the May 25 killing of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officers to reach across the nation, including the Triangle. The night of May 30, a Saturday, began as a peaceful protest in Raleigh, but rapidly escalated as the night wore on. The fire and fury of an angry nation swept across downtown, and some of the city's most iconic businesses were hit. Specific examples can be seen at the Mecca restaurant, which has been in business since 1930. There, workers scrambled in the morning of May 31 to cover the front with plywood. The downtown branch of the YMCA had its front windows completely smashed, and the First Citizens Bank building on Fayetteville Street had its front windows shattered and graffiti on its walls. And on May 31, children worked diligently to clean it. Other businesses, too, saw damage from the first wave of riots. The front of City Restaurant was smashed in. The front of the Kimbrell's Furniture Store was damaged, and many of the windows at the Raleigh Times Bar were shattered. Volunteers swarmed to the hardest-hit areas along and near Fayetteville Street with brooms and dustpans to clean up. So many showed up to help that Bill King, the president and CEO of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, tweeted out that anyone volunteering needed to be careful of the glass. On June 1, Raleigh Mayor Marianne Baldwin implemented a citywide curfew. Peaceful protests continued throughout that next week in Raleigh and across the Triangle, and the mayor rescinded the order. The curfew provided our community the opportunity to pause from the violence and destruction that occurred last weekend while still allowing important conversations to occur, she said at the time. Fast forward to the end of August, and another flashpoint for racial justice sparks more protests, the Jacob Blake shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Raleigh implemented another curfew, and businesses boarded up yet again. Protests also happened at various times across other parts of the Triangle, including Durham and Chapel Hill, where the demonstrations were a bit on the calmer side, though several businesses were vandalized. But from those protests and demonstrations came positive conversations, and those begat a deeper understanding, knowledge, and appreciation of various points of view. Many local business advocacy groups have encouraged positive dialogue in the wake of these protests, including the Greater Durham Black Chamber of Commerce. Triangle Business Journal reported in July that insurance claims in the wake of the riots had hit $10 million statewide, but that figure has since risen. Across the country, the damage that took place mainly to businesses in 140 U.S. cities, including around the Triangle, will lead to at least $1 billion in paid insurance claims, according to an Axios report in September. And in a section called Action Steps, when asked what the most important thing businesses can do to move toward a more cohesive and inclusive community, the president and CEO of the Greater Durham Black Chamber of Commerce, C.J. Broderick, offered up three suggestions. Do their own research around what diversity, inclusion, and equity mean broadly and in a business sense. Advocate for the institutional support of small and disadvantaged business organizations. And join small and disadvantaged business organizations. And now we turn to our continuing series, The Promise Of. The headline, A Bond to Effect Change, how NCCU coach Lavelle Moten and two local businessmen are using their Southeast Raleigh ties to change futures. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the project name is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. Childhood friends are building on the bonds they've had since grade school to ensure that future generations living in Southeast Raleigh have more opportunities and stronger communities. The three businessmen who co-founded Raleigh Raised Development, or RRD, grew up in the same Southeast neighborhood, stayed connected throughout school and work, and decided to leverage the relationships and reputations they've built in their respective careers to effect positive change across the Raleigh landscape. Lavelle Moten, head coach of the men's basketball team at NC Central University, brings a highly visible voice and a passion for philanthropic causes to the trio. His partners, Clarence C.J. Mann Jr. and Terrell Midget, lead highly regarded Raleigh-based businesses. Mann is vice president of Vistibution, a general contracting company that provides environmental remediation, hazmat cleanup, including COVID-19 sanitation, and right-of-way acquisition and consulting services. Midget is co-owner of Management Professionals Incorporated, a facilities management and maintenance company. "We've known each other since we can remember," recounts Moten, "and we have a vision and a name that represents us because we were all raised in Southeast Raleigh." Even before they founded RRD last summer, they had begun establishing grassroots programs to give back to the community and benefit the people living in the neighborhoods where they were raised. The first was the Lavelle Moten Basketball Camp, which has been ongoing for 18 years, except for disruptions during COVID, and which has impacted hundreds of young lives through its mentorship. They include NBA stars such as John Wall, who was the number one draft pick in 2010 for the Washington Wizards, and now plays for the Houston Rockets, along with fellow Raleigh native P.J. Tucker. "It's not only the guys in the NBA. Kids who went through our camp are playing professionally overseas, and we've established some coaches in the area," Moten says. The basketball camp is for both young men and women, and Moten notes many young women have gone on to success as well, like Makia Jones, who attended Temple University on a basketball scholarship. While the basketball camp leads to positive outcomes for many, their focus now is on Raleigh raised and the need to create equity and inclusion in existing and emerging developments. "Over time, we saw Raleigh evolving right before our eyes, and we saw this gentrification happening. Slow at first, then it accelerated," Moten says. "We realized it seemed like everyone is profiting off of our neighborhood and off of our people in our community, except for the people within our communities. That didn't make any sense to me." The business partners recognize two fundamental problems in Southeast Raleigh. Black people did not own property or have access to property ownership, and unlike other areas in Raleigh, these neighborhoods were not included in the prosperity defining much of the triangle. "Raleigh has done a magnificent job of growing across the last 20 years, but it's been a tale of two Raleighs," Midget says. "There's North Raleigh and Southeast Raleigh. The south part of town hasn't seen the type of growth and development that has happened in the north side of town due to RTP and the wave of tech jobs that have come." The first project RRD has become involved with is the city's Lane Idlewild Affordable Housing Initiative, where they have partnered with the Raleigh Area Land Trust and the Southeast Raleigh Promise, nonprofits that are focused on helping first-time buyers and low-income residents gain access to ownership. Mann explains that the proposed Idlewild project will include a mixture of single-family and multiple-unit housing, with plans for a total of 16 cottage court units, 4 that will potentially be sold at market rate and 12 that will be offered as affordable housing, sold at less than 50 to 60% AMI, area medium income. "We all put money in to start Raleigh Raised, and our operating budget is going to be determined by the projects we're involved with," Mann says. The budget for Lane Idlewild is between $3 million and $4 million, but we haven't put a number or budget on the Downtown South project yet. In early December, amid contentious debate surrounding the requested rezoning of the Downtown South project, RRD announced it would become part of the planning and development team. The project, introduced in June 2019 by John Kane, founder of Kane Realty Corporation, and Steve Malik, owner of the North Carolina Football Club and North Carolina Courage professional soccer teams, proposed that Downtown South would entail a $2.2 billion development to bring restaurants, hotels, housing, and a 20,000-seat sports and entertainment stadium. The Raleigh City Council approved the rezoning proposal on December 15, although the Raleigh Planning Commission had voted unanimously against the rezoning request just a week prior. On December 17, the City Council held another special meeting during which the rezoning proposal was again voted on and approved. Similar to the Idlewild project, RRD's involvement with Downtown South is centered on developing equity and affordable housing, but it goes deeper than that. "We've been involved in talks with the planning and development," Midget said, "and it's about more than affordability, it's construction and design. We're at the table with Kane on pretty much everything." Beyond affordable housing, there's a commitment to expand amenities in Southeast Raleigh, as well as job creation and transportation access. The new BRT line in the city of Raleigh is going to run through the Downtown South project, Mann notes. We intend to create opportunities in the construction field for members of the community to go through a workforce development training program for all trades of construction. Once they graduate that program, they'll have an opportunity to work with us and other general contractors on the Downtown South project. The three partners envision Downtown South as becoming an epicenter on that side of town, bringing a diverse set of uses that will attract people and become a vibrant and pedestrian-friendly neighborhood. What folks don't understand about the rezoning, Moten explains, is that it will enable more equitable development than the alternative. It was already zoned for industrial and mixed-use development, so the alternative would be an industrial complex or another high-end development, he says. If the zoning stayed the same, the development team could still create a North Hill South and have no equity, no inclusion, and none of the public benefits that we're talking about. With the rezoning approved, the tax increment grant comes into play and allows for inclusion on the construction side and on the use side. To effect positive change and inclusion in developments across the triangle, Mann suggests that companies should establish decision-making leadership that reflects a diverse set of backgrounds. You need to have a diverse set of guidance that you listen to, not one perspective, and that will help drive your business to your goals, he says. That's what we're achieving here. And we also have two short articles in the Promise Of section. Durham Group among those getting NC Idea funding. Provident 1898, a Durham-based co-working community for entrepreneurs, artists, and innovators, is among 17 recipients of $1.5 million in grant funding from NC Idea, a private foundation that supports entrepreneurship and economic empowerment in our state. With the funding, Provident 1898 will pilot a cohort-based program to equip participants with skills and best practices for acquisition entrepreneurship, which they define as the process of buying and growing the value of established profitable businesses. The program, Acquire, will help build business ownership among minority groups and women disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Acquiring profitable small to middle market companies provides both immediate income and builds wealth for owners and management, said Labone Moses, a business strategist, angel investor, and managing director of the Acquire program. Most Retool NC grants exceeded $21,000. The historically underutilized businesses, or HUB, Small Business Impact Grant Program, Retool NC, which was created to help certify North Carolina HUBs, HUBs, and disadvantaged business enterprise firms, DBEs, recover from the pandemic, has stopped accepting applications. Funded with $12 million, the program has received more than 1,000 applications. The Retool NC portal may be reopened for applications if funds remain after the assessment of existing applicants has been completed. Through the end of November, 209 applications had been approved and more than $4.2 million had been awarded. Of those awarded, 64% ranged from $21,000 to $25,000, 6% were $16,000 to $20,000, and 30% fell between the $10,000 and $15,000 range. Roughly 400 applications remained in the process of being reviewed, and another 400 were determined to be incomplete. Oh, now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. She found her niche in hotels. A Moore County woman who rose from being a coal miner's daughter to entrepreneur has opened her third hotel in Aberdeen. Bonnie McPeak has opened a Hilton Garden Inn with 103 rooms and about 60 employees. McPeak Hotels owns the Hampton Inn and Town Place Suites in Aberdeen. McPeak, 69, and her late husband, Sam, left West Virginia and got into the hotel business with her sister, who had a hotel in Durham. They went out on their own with the Pinehurst Motor Lodge and learned lasting lessons. McPeak recalls how she thought the household staff wasn't keeping the hotel clean enough. The next thing I look out and they're walking off the property. My husband said, Bonnie, I think the help is leaving, she recalls. McPeak called one of the housekeepers who told her they quit because you talked down to us. She apologized, and they returned. I learned a hard lesson, McPeak says. I learned that you've got to treat people the way you want to be treated and respect them the way you want to be respected. She also learned you have to adapt. McPeak switched from exterior hotels to interior ones. She sold properties she had outside Moore County to focus on home base. And she persevered after her husband had a stroke in 1995. And she just opened a third hotel despite a pandemic that saw occupancy drop last March to 20% before reaching 60% in November. Life changes. You've got to be able to regroup and change your plans, she says. And if you can't, you won't stay around. Interest in pets soars in pandemic. Pelotons and toilet paper aren't the only items that are going fast in the pandemic. If you've been in the market for a pet, you've probably seen, for example, that prices for puppies and wait times have risen. One ETF that focuses on pets, ProShares PetCare, has seen its stock price surge from $44.56 to start the year to $71.55 recently. Local shelters are seeing a surge in interest. The SPCA of Wake County says that due to the volume of adoption interest, it may take a week for them to return your call. This week, the SPCA website listed only 14 dogs who are currently available. The longest wait for a home? Kratos, a large black and white male who has been at the shelter for 6 months. Good luck, Kratos. Find your forever home. And that Kratos is spelled K-R-A-T-O-S. Stunning change at Carrie Sass. Sass founder Jim Goodnight turned 78 on January 6th, so it was stunning when the company confirmed Oliver Schabenberger is departing to pursue other interests. Schabenberger has been chief operating officer and was Goodnight's heir apparent. SAS spokeswoman says Jim Goodnight remains at the helm of the company and he is surrounded by a deep leadership bench. SAS rocketed to prominence decades ago with its astute understanding of how to use analytics to improve business performance. But that space is now ultra-competitive and Goodnight's successor has been a key storyline. Goalie story could go Hollywood. The story of the emergency goalie for the Carolina Hurricanes, who became a national sensation when he won a game at Toronto, could become a Disney movie, with television star James Corden involved. David Ayers was called onto the ice February 22 after the Canes' two goalies were injured. Ayers, 42, gave up goals on the first two shots, but then made eight straight saves as the Canes won 6-3. Ayers was a national sensation, making the media rounds in New York City and getting a warm welcome from National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman. And Ayers' wife, Sarah, said on a recent podcast that the story is going to Disney. She said about 10 different producers pitched movie ideas. We decided after everything that the best fit was James Corden, she said. He was amazing to us and such a great down-to-earth family man. Sarah Ayers said Corden talked to one of his neighbors who is very high up in Disney, and the project is now in the early stages. And for Ayers, he talked to James a bunch of times on the phone, she said. HQ sells for $89.7 million. Yes, $89.7 million. That's how much Drawbridge Realty of San Francisco paid just before Christmas for the ICVIA headquarters building in Durham. The property has been the home to former Quintiles since 2009 and dominates the I-40 corridor between Durham and Raleigh. It features 259,531 square feet of Class A office space over 11 stories. ICVIA has the entire building and a lease through 2006. Franklin Street Properties of Massachusetts bought the property in 2011 for $75.8 million. And finally, Lee County Leader moving to Chatham. Michael Smith, Executive Director of the Sanford Area Growth Alliance, will take the lead role this month for the Chatham County Economic Development Corporation. A priority is luring industries for two megasites, the 2,150-acre Triangle Innovation Point Manufacturing Park, and the 1,800-acre Chatham-Siler City Advanced Manufacturing Site. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we have community voices. Triangle area executives talk about 2020 and possibilities in 2021. First, we have Kamari Ankenbrand, Managing Director, Raleigh Lead, JLL. 2020, disruption and challenging the status quo. It was a game of testing mental staying power. Changes had to be made to help our clients walk through the unknown. There were many late nights, a lot of coffee, and a team that pulled together to discover new ways of working. 2021, challenges, bring opportunities that spark change and growth. The strong fundamentals of the Triangle region will make an incredible impact, both locally and nationally. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Larry Robbins, partner, Wyrick Robbins Law Firm. Our business held up surprisingly well in 2020, given the bizarre nature of the year, but the aspect of the year that I will remember most is the initial feeling of isolation and lack of identity. Everyone looked similar, wearing a mask. I walked into our lobby one day, and there was a woman waiting at the front desk, and as I passed her, I asked if she needed assistance. She replied, no, took off her mask briefly, and suggested that I should know my partners better. Oh, well, my less than positive emotions quickly turned to admiration for our team and how quickly they transitioned into seamlessly working in a remote world and their total dedication to providing extraordinary service to many of our struggling clients. For 2021, I'm looking forward to seeing smiling faces in person. Adrian Cole, CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. The impact of 2020 on area businesses was uneven. Some companies saw exponential growth while others struggled to keep their doors open. In 2021, I'm looking forward to recovery for those impacted by the pandemic, civil unrest, and the uncertainty created by the events of 2020. We will continue our work in economic development, diversity, equity, and inclusivity, and economic mobility to ensure economic opportunity and a robust talent pipeline for the region's business community. Angela Connor, CEO, Change Agent Communications. As a fairly new entrepreneur, now in the midst of my third year in business, it is clear to me now the tumult brought on by 2020 is probably exactly what I needed to determine if I'm really cut out for entrepreneurship and if it was truly my path forward. It was a year of new lows professionally, but intentional actions allowed me to rise above and leverage all my talents and skills to succeed in new and different ways. Next is Seppi Saidi, CEO of Seppi Incorporated. I would remember 2020 as an extremely difficult yet transformational year for our company. We began the year having been hit hard by our major client, NCDOT's financial crisis. We were well into the process of diversifying our client base when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Fortunately, our businesses considered essential and the projects that were underway continued to progress. In 2021, I expect further stability and growth for our company across the Southeast with a continued commitment to our resilient and robust culture and brand. Sumit Vora, CEO of Lone Rider Brewing Company. A sense of calm that elucidates. Don't worry about things you can't control. Be empathetic to the humanity in your team and your community. I would remember 2020 as the year we learned who we are. I am looking forward to 2021 with a team that cares with a sense of gratitude. Finally, also thankful for the tough real-world business training that no business school can provide. And we'll stop there to try to fit in one more article. NC State DACA dreamer sues ExxonMobil over $83,000 internship. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. An NC State University student is suing ExxonMobil in federal court, claiming the oil giant is unfairly denying employment to DACA dreamers. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of Aldo De Leon Resendez, a chemical engineering student, accuses Exxon of discrimination for refusing to hire those who have acquired work authorization through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, policy. The lawsuit is seeking class action status. De Leon, according to the lawsuit, arrived in the U.S. at the age of 8 in 2006. In 2012, he was granted authorization to work in the U.S. through DACA. De Leon, a top student at NC State with a 4.0 GPA and membership in the coveted Goodnight Scholars Program, applied for and was offered a spring 2019 chemical engineer internship with Exxon in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. In doing so, he claims to have declined another paid internship offer that would have paid a nearly $2,000 semi-monthly stipend and a $900 per month housing stipend. At Exxon, according to the suit, he was offered a starting salary of $83,000 and received a $3,000 moving allowance. But shortly before the internship was supposed to start, he was notified by Exxon that the offer was being rescinded, purportedly due to his work authorization. Due to the short window of time between the rescission letter and the start of his spring semester, De Leon was unable to obtain an internship to replace the internship, the lawsuit says, adding that De Leon had moved out of his college housing in anticipation of his move to Baton Rouge days later and had to hastily find short-term housing. The lawsuit was filed by attorney William Simpson of Tim Fulton, Walker, and Owen, who didn't immediately respond to a request to comment further on the case. Exxon, through a spokesperson, said it was reviewing the lawsuit and declined to comment. Following a recent federal court order, the Trump administration reinstated the DACA program, which was started under President Barack Obama. The program currently has 640,000 DACA recipients, and an estimated 300,000 undocumented immigrant teenagers could be eligible to apply. The Trump administration had challenged the program in court all the way to the Supreme Court. And we do have some time left to look at return to the community voices. Anthony Blackman, owner of Atlantic Tire and Service Company, on the Viewpoint page. I never knew that the term essential would mean so much to my employees and our business. Being essential meant that we would at least have the opportunity to have our doors open for business and our employees would still have access to their jobs. We felt the impact of the state measures to protect our citizens. Our car counts were decimated by up to 50%. Our next challenge became what would our options be to address this harmful reduction in our car count. In our sales and management meeting, it became apparent that we would have to extend our services to include free pickup and delivery of our customers' vehicles at their homes or workplaces and return their vehicles sanitized back to them. It worked. Car counts began to rise again, and the community truly seemed to appreciate our efforts. Our employees have appreciated that we remained fully staffed, and in two of our locations, we've added staff. Jim Hansen, Regional President, PNC Bank. For PNC, 2020 was a year of action and impact, from urgently transitioning more than 1,000 local employees to a virtual work environment, to registering thousands of PPP loans for NC businesses, to deploying critical grant funding to Triangle nonprofits. I'll never forget the agility and compassion my colleagues demonstrated when serving our customers and the innovation of our community embraced to achieve resilience. Helping bring recovery to life throughout our region is my greatest motivator for 2021. And Tom Rue, President and CEO, NC Idea. I will remember 2020 for how it tested our resolve. The pandemic is the greatest challenge faced by entrepreneurs in a generation, and the foundation responded with an unprecedented funding and programmatic effort. Despite the challenges, we deployed more capital and helped more people, proving to ourselves that we could overcome adversity posed by the pandemic. With a dramatic increase in people starting new firms, we enter 2021 ready to help them build the companies and create the jobs we will need for a strong recovery. And we're going to stop there, as we've read all of the articles in the Triangle Business Journal. Oh, and we've also run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.